I'm on the phone with Dr. S, and I thank you for participating in this interview. I think the content that you're going to share is going to be very helpful to the listeners. To start, just to frame your own professional expertise, because I think that in itself is going to be helpful to the audience. Can you just say, describe what kind of a doctor you are and what kind of work you do?
I'm a specialist physician, and I'm working in a major city in a university in Canada. It involves not only patient care, but education of medical students, residents, and we are very big in research. So I work in a major university in Canada, in a big city, and as a specialist physician.
Okay, now, can you describe what was going on with your daughter when you originally contacted me?
I contacted you when my daughter was 5 years old. I must say that at that time, she was pretty shy. Her talks were very limited. In school, she may talk, but not in a way that an average child would speak. She would avoid most of the situations. Our social activities were very limited. She needed a lot of help in even doing conversations with the kids in the park or our even relations and close friends. Every social event was kind of a fearful thing for us because of this. And we were really concerned because she was not enjoying what she was doing. We had a feeling that, she wants to do, but she cannot do.
How did you originally come across the term selective mutism?
Well, I think it takes a long way back. We even had this suspicion when she was almost like 2 years old. She was not talking very well. Initially, we thought it was kind of a disability in learning or things like that. We went to the experts when she was 2 years, and I must say that we are in a big city in Canada, and they've diagnosed, one of the experts diagnosed autism, one of them Asperger, another person said it was normal, and another person said it was kind of obsessive personality disorder. So we went in some of those routes and got some training, but as you can see, our gut feeling said, this is not the thing. But the specialist kept reinforcing their decision and the treatments or therapy accordingly. So we had a little bit of success in there, but it was very fluctuating. And many people in our relation said, you'll be fine with time. So we had nearly 3 years with the kind of fluctuating success and defeat. But I must say that nobody was sure of the diagnosis.
So when you started your work with me, I like to measure everything on a scale of 1 to 10. So measuring the severity of the problem at that point in time, and there are different layers to the problem. Obviously, the thing that, or the dynamic that had your attention the most was her difficulty with using words and speaking. But there was an underlying lack of happiness. There was anxiety. There was a self-esteem thing. There was the talking problem. There was the detachment thing. So the severity of the problem, 1 to 10, if 10 was the most initially, what number would you have given it?
If 10 out of 10 is the best and 0 out of 10.
No, if 10 is the most severe.
So I would say she was probably at around 8 out of 10 in the beginning.
Okay, now we're going to just flash forward for a minute. So you guys graduated from treatment recently, so if it was an 8-ish when you started and now we're going down the scale and 1 is basically perfect, what number would you give it at this point?
I would say 2 out of 10, so that we have some room.
Okay, so describe the progress. Describe what you see now that you feel good about.
Well, I think she's just finished her kindergarten, and she's considered to be one of the smartest kids in the class now. She's always happy. The teachers and the and her friends describe her as a very friendly and happy kid. He's into almost all the social activities an average kid would do. And we are so happy that, you know, we can see that she's enjoying what she's doing. And everybody who even meet her for a while tells us that, oh, your daughter's very smart. She's doing very well. So it's a very, very pleasant situation at this time.
Talk specifically about where she is, about how her verbal performance has improved.
Well, I think, I must say, a couple of my friends said that, oh, she's only 6 years, she almost talks like eight or nine. That's where she is. And many people would say that, oh, she's a kind of chatterbox. So,
a chatterbox, right. And you showed me the video. She was on stage and she was actively singing. And the thing that I love, you know, when we do our sessions by Skype and I can see you guys, she's very free-flowing with her words. I mean, it's a wonderful thing. Give another specific example of where she's free with her words now, where originally she was not.
Well, I think, say for example, there was a graduation ceremony, and it's like all the kids and there, all the parents and the cameras flashing and everything. And at the end of it, you know, we have a photo session around, you know, 10 kids, posing for the photo. We could even hear her talking so loudly that she's almost like she's leading the show there. So much enjoyment and happiness there. Similarly, when we go to a program and she's on the stage, she's so thrilled about doing that. There is no anxiety. She's excited to do it, and she poses in front of everyone for the pictures. It's like almost like a miracle.
All right, now we're going to do the difficult part of this discussion, because it is my intention when people listen to an interview like this that they can, not only do they think of this as a testimonial, and I do thank you for that, but I want to give the listeners insight regarding how we achieve success. Okay, so the first part of the treatment was to get some realistic education about what selective mutism was. You had received diagnoses previously like autism, learning disability, personality disorder, etc. Okay, so we arrived at the conclusion that selective mutism was a variation of OCD, the obsessiveness being the thinking worry and anxiety, the compulsion being the verbal shutdown. Okay, so the first step after that was mother and father getting to be on the same team and learning how not to enable the problem. Could you please comment on that?
I think that is one of the most important steps, because here I must say that, you know, the father and mother, they are the therapists, actually. We have to be on the same team, in the same wavelength to have the best results. And part of it is, I should say, Jonathan, that it is your ability to diagnose correctly and also to give us the clear instruction, feedback, and setting a path. And part of the thing before we were not on the same team is because we were not clear. We were confused. There's no diagnosis. We don't know where we are going. So how can we be on the same team? The moment we started talking to you, we got the correct diagnosis. Both of us agreed, yes, this is the thing. Then we got the clear instructions. I must say that, you know, I was probably leading the show and my wife was a little bit, trailing along, but she also understood this is the way to go. That is important in getting on the same team. And that is most important for the daughter, because she sees a uniform approach, a one kind of approach rather than a zigzag manner from the parents before. So when she sees that approach, then it's easy for her to get in to the track as well.
Can you give a couple of examples of how you learned not to enable? Now, I want the listeners to just be careful here. I strongly advise somebody who's listening to this interview not to run out and to copy what you're saying right now, because the process of non-enabling was learned methodically. the word methodology is very important. But just give a couple of examples of how you learned how not to enable.
I think the moment you said about the non-enabling, we understood intellectually that this is the right way to do it. But it was so hard. It was heartbreaking in it because just imagine you were doing that all the time. And we were thinking we were helping her. But we were helping her not to change at that time. But to non-enable, it takes a lot of courage and a lot of preparation. If, for example, you go to you just go for a walk, neighbor comes along and ask the daughter, oh, how are you, sweetie? And where are you going? And she doesn't say. Those 5 seconds or even 10 seconds look like an hour of torture to us. But we have to hang in there, not to help her, let her talk. If she doesn't talk, we'll say, oh, she's not in a mood to talk. It's so simple, but it's so hard to do initially, but that was very, very important.
So when you were implementing a technique that I refer to as freeze the moment. So when you were freezing the moment and you were breaking the reflex of her expectation that you were going to do the thinking and the talking for her, and you see her struggling, and this is a biggie here, what kind of emotions did you have to deal with when she was not speaking to the person who was trying to interact with her?
Oh, well, I think, as I said, those 10 or 20 seconds would be like an hour, and you can see my daughter's pain on the face, and my lips would start speaking even when my brain say like no. So it is very, very, very hard, but it is very important to be consistent at that point. It was really, really a torture in the beginning, but looking back, you know, I think when we are seeing the results, that's the best thing we did.
Okay, now we're moving on to what I think, in addition to the non-enabling, is probably the most important part of treatment and the most difficult for the parents to do, and that is how you learned how to process with your daughter. And the way that I'm using the term processing, it was the process of how you helped her identify thoughts, feelings, reasoning. It was getting her neural, N-E-U-R-A-L, for those listeners who don't understand what I'm talking about, pathways to work in a way that they were previously being underused. So can you talk about how you did that?
Of course. I mean, that is a very important step as well, the processing. And the most important thing I felt was that, you know, we should never get emotional at that time when we do the processing. It's just easy to be. But the important thing that we got help is that we are not processing when it is happening. That is a very good advice from you and a very good strategy. Whenever it happens, something happens, freeze that moment, and you're not talking at that time. And if you talk or process at that time, you'll be emotional anyways. And then you come home in the evening, by the time you got enough preparation, and you train yourself emotionally attached to it or emotionally involved with it, and then you go in a neutral way. What happened? This has happened, and that person asked this question, and you didn't answer. What was going in your mind? What do you think the other person felt? I mean, these are questions, actually, even though she didn't answer initially, made her understand the situation and think about in her own brain, oh, what's going on? Why did I do like that? What the other person felt? So simple things, but that really helped her to think in a different way, out of the box, and come out of her shell. Initially, it was not forthcoming, and we had to be patient and consistent. But within you know, a couple of months, things started improving, and then she started giving us answers, which are very good. And we used to email you those kind of talks, and then I look back and I read through them. I can see the improvement with each month, actually.
Okay, you're saying a lot of important things here. You said that at the beginning, she was not forthcoming. And this is what I want parents to understand. Just because you ask the kid a question and they don't respond, that's when the parents have to really deal with their own frustration. It doesn't mean that the child is not processing. You're facilitating attachment. You're bringing issues to a conscious level. And I've got to say that you did a heck of a good job, and you are a role model for the fathers out there, because you did you took the lead in the parenting therapy here. And most fathers, I hate to be sexist, but in most cases, it's the mother, I would say in 95% of the cases, it's the mother who, in essence, pilots or quarterbacks the process. So it's all to your credit. And I have to tell you that when I was interacting with your daughter, either by phone or by Skype, I felt it was so gratifying to see her put the sentences together, the thoughts together, the reasoning together, and that did take a lot of work. Okay, now let's touch on the issue of medicine, and I want to be really careful here because most people, most parents who have a child, a young child like this, want a quick fix. A quick fix is not possible in most cases. It takes some hard work.
Yes.
But anyway, we did use medicine at a specific time for a specific reason, for specific objectives. Can you please, and I appreciate the fact that you're a physician commenting on this, could you comment on how we use the medicine?
Of course. I think there are two things with the medicine. One, many people have a feeling that, no, medicine is a chemical. We shouldn't use that in kids. That is wrong. And second thing is that, okay, medicine is an easy fix. You know, you just give the medicine and she's performing, that's fine. I think both these concepts are wrong, and I personally, I don't like to use medicine at all, but the way you convinced us and showed us was so impressive, and we used the medicine in a very low dose. We used it only when he was ready for it. Say, for example, she started the thought process that, okay, well, I have to improve upon talk, I had to perform this way. That was deep-rooted in her mind, but she was not getting the courage. And that's the right time in which we added the medicine as per your instruction, and that did really wonders. And once she stabilized in the performance, we gradually weaned off. It was only a very low dose, only for 9 months. We weaned it off. It's almost like, you know, just planting the tree, like you make the soil correct, you put the water, and the right moment you add a little bit of fertilizer, and that's it. I think I'm so impressed with the way we use the medicine and stop it now, and she's consistent now, you know, even without the medicine.
That was a very good analogy you just used. And just to elaborate, when you said that when she was ready, you first did the work of getting the parents to be on the same team. You did a lot of non-enabling work. You got her attention that expectations were different. And then when she was stuck because of the OCD dynamic at work, the medicine really helped create a sense of internal ease to help her negotiate the process. And then what we did was, we took her, after a certain level of success, confidence, and happiness had been attained, then we gradually took her off, and now she's been off completely. Okay, now the last couple of questions here. Yes. Number one is, how is your life different now that this problem has been resolved?
Well, I think when our kids have a problem, your mind is stuck, not moved. Like, it's like a continuous thought. And also to see that she is suffering, it is heartbreaking. So within this year, I mean, we have moved out of that. Now we are very happy with what she is doing. We are enjoying every day. Wherever we go, we are happy. I say that we have to go to a party, she's excited. When I see her excitement, I'm excited. So it's like it's a very, very pleasant situation now. Initially, like when we are going through the processing and your technique was hard to do, and many a times we had like we were struggling to keep up, and we had a little bit of emotional problems at that time. But you know, everything is worth it, because all is well that ends well, and we are very happy with how she's doing.
Last question. What advice do you have for parents who are in the same situation that you experienced?
Well, I think the message is very clear. I would say if you have any concern about your kid, you are probably right. And don't just sleep on it. Just get the right help early enough, and earlier the better. That's number one. And I think I must say that, Jonathan, you are probably the best in this field. And I can see the response within a year, and I'm so happy with it. Second thing is that, you know, so get the right help early. Second thing, don't give up. I mean, you may find it hard to do, but no pain, no gain. And if you're not taking the pain, then you're not getting the gain. The third thing I would say is that be realistic in the goals. Don't expect that, you know, every kid has their own temperament and their own levels and their own personality. So don't expect the girl to be the, you know, superstar. So have realistic expectations. I mean, we can always push the limits, but have realistic expectations. These are the three things I would say. And I have one specific comment about maybe single parents. I mean, there may be many out there like that, thinking, you know, I'm alone. Or there are parents were, who don't get enough help from the partner. My comment is that it's still doable. In my case, actually, you know, after some time, I realized that my wife, even though she wants to help a lot, she's not have the same capacity. So instead of slowing down, I just went ahead. She supported me as an assistant. I run the show. It's doable. So that's my specific comment. But otherwise, the three things: get help early, don't give up, have a realistic goal.
Dr. S, thank you very, very much.
You're very welcome, and thank you very much, Nathan, for everything that you did.